I'm very mindful of the time, and because we've got such a distinguished panel, I know Peter wants to have questions, and I want to hear some of the answers that I expect will be prompted by those questions. So what I wanted to do is just to reflect on, as an outsider coming from the area of commercial law, I was asked to consider issues of financial loss and computer decision making, but I don't think that gets us away from considering and reflecting on these issues of principled decision making against principles of transparency and accountability, principle of legality and of procedural fairness. We seem to have a zoological theme of running through this afternoon, in the afternoon. It's really an allusion to following the yellow brick road in order to try and assist people to obtain redress. Just see if I'll get this machine to work. Green? Funnily enough. In relation to the defective administration scheme, I just wanted to make two very brief remarks, a couple of brief remarks about that scheme, to alert you to some recent decisions on the tort misfeasance of public office, and then spend some time talking about the future of computerised decision making, because I think that raises just enormous questions both on practical and analytical levels that ultimately each of us will have to grapple with in the future, and the principles of administrative decision making and the law that is bound up around that and of review really requires a great deal of consideration, and it's only going to be harder, and unless we start thinking about it sooner, we won't even realise that there are avenues for redress or reasons to seek redress because of mistakes or errors or capriciousness. In relation to, let's skip past it. The point about these schemes is that they're administrative, discretionary, permissive schemes. They're very much, this scheme and the scheme of active grace payments are really the last resorts in terms of asserting some kind of financial redress. They're there when there is no common law or statutory right, and they depend upon assistance, depend upon, in a sense, an acknowledgement by the administration that there is a moral obligation nonetheless to redress the detriment that has been suffered. You can see the kind of administration. I'm not a practitioner in migration law, but just looking at the kind of administrative decisions, administrative action, you can see that there is an enormous scope for you to consider for your clients, or if acting for a government institution. I want to make two points about this. The first is that you'll see that there's a reasonableness test in relation to two of them. But the last one about giving advice to an applicant that's incorrect or ambiguous, it doesn't have a reasonableness test, but it does have a reasonableness test when you come to assess the foreseeability of the pure economic loss that you might be claiming, and in relation to the reliance, whether it was reasonable to seek the advice of the government entity and to rely upon it. Anyone here ever made an application under this scheme for a client? George might speak to it. Do you want to just? No. The first thing I want to say about this, it is very hard to find information about the use and success of this scheme. I have had my researchers trawling through annual reports, not just for the department, but others such as the ATO and ASIC and other departments. And either their information just isn't there, it's not quantified, doesn't tell anything about it, or it's there and it still doesn't really assist you. Nonetheless, doesn't mean it can't be tried. There are reports from 2013 and 14 of successful claims against the ATO. And you can sort of see why that would be, because it's very black and white in terms of the claim that might be made. But nonetheless, Form 1459 and Form 1458, which is the Act of Grace application form for the Department of Immigration are there to be pursued. I have got claims in the financial services sector where, for example, ASIC has ordered a license to be removed, which means a business effectively shut down overnight. It gets overturned in the AAT and the federal court, but the business is gone. So is that a direct financial claim? And you can think about it if someone was held in detention wrongfully and they've lost their job, they've lost their employment, or they didn't get a business visa, or, you know, there's different ways one can think creatively and strategically about that. There's a relevant regulatory guide there to guide the decision maker, to guide you and to assist you. I've got that there, and I've got a written paper on this and I'll put on my website if anyone wants any more detail about it. Act of grace, very much a last resort, and you won't hear much about it. It's another way of saying, I mean, in a way, it's almost a way that you could imagine the more egregious claims being settled through an act of grace payment. Misfeasance. I want to say this about misfeasance. I thought about it in the context of some of the conduct that's required and might be anticipated in relation to the border security activities. And I have appeared at ICAC a number of times, so I won't say much about, and I have cases involving it, and I won't say much about the facts of this case, but I wanted to bring it to your attention because it's the most recent case on the tort of misfeasance in public office. And it's a judgment of Justice Hammerschlag from last year. And it's a great way of sort of casting across whatever circumstance you're considering about the conduct of an individual, or conduct of the department or another government entity, whether or not there's an actionable claim. The first thing I wanted to draw to your attention is about they must hold a public office. And in this case, there was a claim made against each of ICAC, Commissioner Ip, former judge, the counsel assisting, and two of the special investigators of ICAC. And the only person to be held to have held a public office in that case was the commissioner. The institution itself of ICAC was held not to be a public office. And one of the points about the tort of misfeasance, it's a claim against a person. It's not a claim against the person's employer. So you can see, and one of the questions that Peter raised with me was, you know, where a lot of departmental conduct is being subcontracted out to government to non-corporate Commonwealth entities, but they're corporate other entities, you know, where's your path through? Now, probably on principles of agency, there'd be arguments whether or not they effectively are the relevant body. But you're going to have quite difficult stepping through of that. The essence of the tort of misfeasance is bad faith. The principles of those administrative schemes and the act of grace is that they're really directed to where there is no legal liability. But there's a huge gulf. If the only thing that you've got in between is negligence, then you've either got a really inadequate, quite properly criticised by the Ombudsman scheme on this side, and then really difficult claims on the other. I mentioned this one about the offence of misconduct in public office is because if I can imagine a circumstance, I mean, the most recent person to be convicted of this was Eddie Obeid, but it's on appeal. But the thing about that is there might be a criminal compensation claim available in relation to any physical harm or financial. Decision making. I'll just use my last moments on this. We're thinking of novelty and novel claims and novel experiences. This is where we are and where we'll be. I'm on the Law Council's Future Australian Legal Profession Committee, and we look at this, and this is something that is considering not just in people's practices, but the reality of law and the way that we engage with it. Why do we have it? Or why is this our future? Well, of course, cost and speed, but also assumptions of reliability. But it's that assumption that is the one that you'd be wanting to very carefully consider. The Centrelink situation was this. You can see, why is it important for us? You can see how wide and how large scale the effect was against in relation to people caught up in the situation. The scale of it is one aspect. But it raises these questions: who's the decision maker and who's got the authority? Is it the programmer? Is it the policy maker and the authorised decision maker, or is it the computer itself? Why is that relevant? Because what is happening, there's a difference between assisted, so technology assisted decision making, and actual automated decision making. If there's, in the first category, you've got a human involved still, and they may be using information that's been generated by a computer, but they still are the person making the decision and perhaps exercising a discretion. But in the world of Watson, which is the computer that's the AI, the artificial intelligence that's being developed, where there will be actual discretionary decision-making capability, how does one grapple with that? You'll have issues of judicial review. It'd be quite expensive. You'll have to demonstrate understand the computer programming. Has the error come in the translation of the government policy or law into the programming itself? So is there an error at that level, or are assumptions being made? So Centrelink, and this is the last thing I'll say because I'm conscious of the time, the Centrelink problem was this, as I understand it, that they generated, by using income information that had been collected, and then averaging that out over, assuming that that applied throughout the whole of the year, then said, well, this is the income that you had for the year. But of course, people earn income at different times of the year, and they may have been unemployed for large portions. And so they were quite right to be obtaining unemployment benefits in the periods in which they weren't earning an income. But that was a fault of the assumptions that were put into the decision. And then there was the issue of, was it really a decision that was being sent out, that was being communicated in the correspondence, or did the decision really come when people then tried to engage with that computer-generated correspondence? And it was at that point when they then came in to either affirm or to challenge the amount under that was being asserted, that they were then crystallising it as a debt. And then it was being said, and trying to shift an onus. So there's a whole range of, in effect, both assisted decision making and computer decision making. How do you get in behind it? And I think that the only thing I would be raising is that you may just end up back where we started, which is if judicial review and merits review aren't getting you there, because really it's a large scale, problem. You're back at the relying on what are essentially inadequate administrative schemes, which means there has to be pressure from justice groups and those who understand it working together to try and obtain redress. Thank you.
Yes, question at the back.